Folks, we're going to get started in about a minute.
Thanks. Just came in. They put this clock up here for us.
Oh.
There's no way of staying on time.
Hey, it even matches.
It matches very closely. So I've been kind of making sure that we stayed for that.
No excuse. Okay, if you'll take your seats, please, we will go into round two of this series of testimonial talks for our honoree, Phil Christensen. And leading off this session is our good friend Hat McSween, who will tell us ground truth for mineralogic and petrologic mapping. Hat.
Okay. And where's the pointer?
It's right there. It'll change colors when you have 3 minutes left.
So we are talking about mineral and rock maps on planets, and I'm going to try to share some thoughts with you about what I think we can say about ground truthing those maps. Not the contacts, but maybe the interpretations of what the minerals or rocks are. So let me remind you of what kinds of orbital assets we have for maps. We have Mars Global Surveyor TESS, which we have been talking a great deal about, one of Phil's instruments that gives us mineralogy. As Mike Wyatt already mentioned, you can do unnatural acts with this mineralogy and convert it to chemistry. That was not something that was ever intended, but basically, if you deconvolve the spectra into a set of minerals, modal mineralogy, and you know the compositions of the minerals in your spectral library, then you can see how you could calculate a chemistry. I'll remind you that the footprints for TESS are relatively small compared to the other data set I'm going to talk about. But TESS samples the outermost few microns, and the data are limited to dust-free areas of Mars. We also have information from Mars Odyssey gamma ray spectrometer, and this data set is chemistry. The reason I'm going to talk about chemistry is we have this dirty little secret that on Earth we do not classify volcanic rocks by their mineralogy. We classify them by the chemistry because the mineralogy is so variable for even a given rock type. So if we want to, since we think that Mars is predominantly covered with volcanic rocks, we need ways to get at chemistry, which is one of the reasons we try to do this through TESS as well. GRS samples to a much greater depth, but it has huge footprints. And only gives us a limited number of elements, and the data that I'm going to show you have had hydrogen removed. Basically, a hydrogen mask has been applied, and then the data have been renormalized to hydrogen-free. I'm going to compare that with some ground truth, and one of the ground truths is data from the Spirit rover and Gusev crater. Phil Christensen has famously pointed out that although the Opportunity rover in Meridiani has gotten most of the attention, the Spirit rover is really important because it looks like most of Mars. And since I'm going to be comparing with global maps, Spirit is a much better ground truthing tool than data from Meridiani would be. I'm going to look at rock compositions that have been abraded by the rock abrasion tool or brushed in some cases. We'll be looking at some soil analyses too, and also we can get mineralogical information from the Mini-TESS instrument, another of Phil's babies, and constrained by Mossbauer mineralogy as well. And I'm also going to be looking at data from Martian meteorites. I want to call your attention to this funny-looking diagram over here. These are ejection ages for Mars in millions of years as determined from cosmic ray exposure ages. And what I want you to see is these are the different kinds of Martian meteorites, and that the data are clumped, and in each clump there is one kind of Martian meteorite. So the inference from that is each of these represents a distinct impact event, a different place on Mars that was sampled by these Martian meteorites. And the important point is that although we don't know exactly where the Martian meteorites come from, we have more sites than have been visited and studied on the ground by spacecraft, so we really can't ignore these data. And they do have biased age sampling. All of the ones that I'm going to talk about are 1.3 billion years or younger, so they don't sample all of Mars. Mars geologic history, but we can do complete mineralogy and chemistry on them. So here is a first map we'll look at. This is Mike Wyatt's TESS olivine distribution map. And let me point out where the Spirit rover sits. It is right on the edge of this brown area, which is dust covered and doesn't really allow us to see olivine, but let's focus on olivine as a way to see whether ground truth can confirm what the various instruments might be telling us about in our maps. A problem is that Gusev itself is dust covered except for some sand dunes that may not be indigenous. I asked one of Phil's former students, Deanne Rogers, who has just published a real nice paper defining various test terrains, what the terrain that is closest to Gusev would be, and she identified this Highlands Group 3. And so the mineralogy, the deconvolved mineralogy of that is shown in these blue bars. Earlier this year, I and a cast of hundreds published a paper where we rather tediously considered all of the rover data and came up with what we think is the best estimate of mineralogy of the basalts in that litter the floor of Gusev crater. So that's the data in red. And then the mineralogy of Gusev soils has not really been determined yet, but I've tried using the same technique that we employed here to determine the mineralogy of Gusev, average Gusev sands. And what I expected was that these blue bars would be something in between the rocks and the soil, maybe closer to the soil, but maybe something in between. And you can see that although all of these methods, these different methods, are identifying the same minerals, the proportions really don't agree that well, and in fact this TESS Highlands Group 3 has lower olivine than we are seeing on the ground and higher proportions of secondary minerals. Well, let's see how well the Martian meteorites do, although now we're going to look at global data sets since we're not exactly sure where these are from. But here are olivine compositions in this diagram going from the iron-rich to the magnesium-rich end member. Here are the ranges for test deconvolutions. Here are the ranges of olivines measured in olivine-bearing Martian meteorites, and they overlap beautifully. And here are various determinations using different techniques of the olivine composition in Gusev basalts, and that overlaps quite nicely too. Here are olivine proportions globally from TESS. Here are the proportions of olivines in the meteorites. Again, pretty good overlap. And the proportions at this one site at Gusev that at least fit in with that. So mineralogically, I don't think this is a bad test. Let's look at petrology, and by way of introduction, we'll start with this figure that you have seen before, differentiating test surface type 1, which is conventionally interpreted as basalt, and surface type 2, which is sometimes interpreted as andesite or sometimes as partly altered basalt. And to get at that, we need, if we're going to deal with petrology, we need geochemistry. And here's an attempt to do that. This is a diagram of alkalis versus silica that is used by terrestrial petrologists to classify volcanic rocks. And It's kind of a complicated diagram, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time on it. The Martian meteorite key is here. They all plot here in the field of basalts. This bounce rock is a Martian meteorite-like rock that was found in Meridiani, Planum, by the rover. The compositions of Gusev rocks, ratted or brushed, are the blue symbols here. If it's the same rock, they're connected with tie lines, and the Gusev soils are red dots. They also plot in the field of basalt. Also shown on here are all of the GRS data for the entire globe, in expressed as an average and a average composition and standard deviation. That's the size of the box here. Now, I need to confess that GRS analyzes potassium, but it does not analyze sodium. So to do this, I've assumed the average sodium to potassium ratio for Gusev in deriving that. If I had picked the average sodium to potassium ratio for the Martian meteorites, then this box would be up here in the stratosphere somewhere, which is kind of unrealistic. So where that is vertically is probably not very well constrained, but clearly the GRS data indicate that this is a basalt-covered world. Also shown on here is a composition for the Mars Pathfinder soil-free rock, dust-free rock, and chemistry derived from deconvolved analyses of surface type 1 and surface type 2 from test data. And they do not agree with other data sets. And in particular, surface type 2 plots over here like andesite, which produce the, in part, the hypothesis that surface type 2, the original hypothesis that it was andesite. So there is a real difference here, and I will come back to why that is in a little bit, but just realize that this data set really doesn't agree with everything else. I've also shown some soils from other sites here, but I'm not really going to talk about those. This idea that there's not a lot of silica-rich rocks on Mars is borne out by more detailed mapping. Here you see one of Phil's this is one of from Phil's papers of what has been interpreted as a dacite flow in a volcano. I think that's probably correct. And here one of Phil's students has found quartzo-feldspathic material in some craters, but it is extremely uncommon. And this is consistent with the idea that there really isn't much in the way of high silica rocks on the surface of Mars anyway. Okay, here's a GRS global map of calcium over silicon. You're not used to seeing ratio maps out of GRS data, but since that's what I'm plotting in these diagrams, I changed these to ratio maps. And I've compared it, tried to compare it with some ground truth to get some sense of whether or not these data agree with an average of Mars Pathfinder site compositions, opportunity, and spirit compositions, and the data sets you can see there in parentheses. And there's very good agreement, except here for spirit, where the value is a little low compared to the color coding, but it's great for these others. I can't really explain why that is, but you can see that same thing here. Here's the GRS calcium-silicon ratio, and here's the spirit data, which is a little lower. GRS does not measure magnesium, so we don't have that value. This particular diagram is used to chemically classify Martian meteorites, and you can see that they're nicely differentiated. Here are the different kinds of Martian meteorites in these little encircled areas, and then the noclites up here. And at least for the shergotites, there is a very nice correlation here, which probably arises because it's an olivine mixing line. And if we wanted to estimate a global magnesium-silicon ratio for Mars, even though GRS doesn't give it to us, we could take the average GRS calcium-silicon where it intersects this line, and that might be the value. Or we could do the same thing by using the average Gusev data. And if you do that, you get virtually the same result. So this is a way of estimating magnesium in the Martian crust, which I'm going to use in a little bit. Now I'm going to shift gears and talk about iron. Here's an iron-silicon map iron silicon ratio map, and again, Pathfinder, Opportunity, and Spirit Ground Truth, and these agree almost exactly with the color codings that you see there. Okay, now we're going to use that magnesium value that we calculated, and this is a plot of FeO star, which means total iron calculated as FeO, regardless of what its oxidation state, divided by MgO, plotted against silica. This is a diagram that is near and dear to the hearts of petrologists because it is used to distinguish foliatic and calc-alkaline magmas. You're probably wondering, well, what does that mean and who cares? Foliatic magmas form by partial melting and fractionation of largely water-free or water-poor magmas, and calc-alkaline magmas form by wet melting, which produces magmas along this arrow, big arrow here, and then fractionation of those hydrous magmas, which then move them up this way. And what you can see is the whole data set, GUSEF, GRS, data set using that magnesium value that we calculated, and the Martian meteorites all plot in the tholeiitic field. However, the chemical data derived from TESS deconvolutions plot in the calc-alkaline field. A few years ago, McSween et al., this wasn't me, it was my evil twin, proposed that these data were for older rocks on Mars, and what this represented was a period in early Mars history when the mantle was wetter, and when it partially melted, it produced calc-alkaline rocks that dominated the early Martian crust. And then that act of partial melting removed the water, so that when you partially melted that mantle later to make the Martian meteorites, you got tholeiitic magmas. But these GUSEF rocks are old too, and they are tholeiitic. So I think that this idea probably has to be abandoned now. Okay, so why are we getting this difference in the test-derived chemistry and the other chemistries? And I think we've already alluded to this in a number of talks in this session. Here's a picture of an alteration rind on a partially ratted GUSEF rock. These alteration rinds are ubiquitous. They also occur at Meridiani. I have the feeling they are a common feature in Martian rocks. And the soils on Mars, the rocks on Mars also smear along this way, which is an olivine leaching pattern. So what we're seeing is alteration by acidic fluids that has modified the compositions of rock surfaces and soils. And so this may be a function of the fact that we're using a technique that looks at the very surface rather than the total rock petrology. So to conclude, test mineral identifications and deconvolved mineral abundances are broadly consistent with the mineralogy of GUSEF rocks and soils and with some Martian basaltic meteorites. But test data do indicate more alteration phases, which I think makes perfectly good sense. The chemical composition of Martian basaltic meteorites and GUSEF rocks and soils agree reasonably well with the global GRS data, although neither is a perfect match. And the Martian crust is mostly tholeiitic basalt, suggesting a small role for magmatic water. Siliceous rocks are uncommon, indicating limited crustal differentiation. Test-derived geochemistry reflects rock surface and rock alteration and does not agree with other data sets and previous speculations about calc-alkaline magmatism based on those test-derived chemistries, I think, were probably incorrect. And I will say, though, that the complementary nature of TESS and GRS data make both very useful in interpreting the mineralogy and petrology of the maps that we make. and the ground truth provided by rovers and Martian meteorites can add confidence in those maps that are made using orbital data. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Happy to have time for a question or two. Yes.
So one point about the Alpine diagram and the test data. In that 2003 paper, isn't one of the points that if these are older rocks, we should not even be plotting them there in the first place?
That's a very good point. In the paper, we had an out. We said, if they are igneous rocks, they're calcalkaline. If we're looking at altered compositions, then we should not be using this diagram. And the answer was the second one. We should not be using that diagram. That's a good point.
Okay, thank you, Hap.
Yeah.
The next presentation is by Steve Ruff, entitled Diversity and Distribution of Amorphous Silicate Phases on Mars. Steve?